In our study of the book of Ruth, we've come to chapter 3, which I'm going to read. Ruth chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, referring to Ruth, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself. Put on your best garment and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down. And he will tell you what you should do." And she said to her, "All that you say to me, I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. She came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Now, it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. And she said, "Who are you?" So she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative." Then he said, "Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. Now, it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a close relative for you, good, let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will perform the duty for you. As the Lord lives, lie down until morning." So she lay at his feet until morning, and she arose before one could recognize another. Then he said, "Do not let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor." Also he said, "Bring the shawl that is on you and hold it." And when she held it, he measured 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her. Then she went into the city. When she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "Is that you, my daughter?" Then she told her all that the man had done for her. And she said, "These 6 ephahs of barley he gave me, for he said to me, 'Do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" Then she said, "Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out. The man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day." Before we start the lesson proper, I have one correction and then one sort of amusing observation. The correction is that last week when I was listing the duties of the kinsman redeemer, I said that the kinsman redeemer had to pay restitution for a relative. It was actually that the kinsman redeemer was the one who received restitution when a relative had died, which doesn't sound like too bad a deal. It's better than chasing after people to kill them, I guess. But that was just to reinforce the idea that the kinsman redeemer acted to represent the family. And then, as we've gone through the book, we've looked at various lessons that you could learn from the book and the purpose of the book. One commentator I was reading refers to another commentator, who I think is probably not an evangelical. Anyway, this other commentator says that the purpose of the book is entirely entertainment, that it's written simply to be a good story. But he joked that if anything, its teaching would be that men be on guard before beautiful, clever women. Okay. Now, of course, that's in a sense nonsense, but there is an element of truth there, and the chapter today reinforces that sense that we have before us beautiful, clever women who in the end find the way to what they were trying to accomplish. Okay, so back to the chapter proper. You remember from last week we ended with the clause, "She," that is Ruth, "dwelt with her mother-in-law." And I commented last week, I think, that that's really not the way it should be, because she's a young woman, she's wanting to get married, and so she shouldn't be dwelling with her mother-in-law, she should find a husband. Now, that idea of finding a husband and the need for the security that the husband brings is Again, it's a little difficult for us from our point of view to recognize, but I'll stress yet again part of the distance between us and that time obscures the fact of how desperate the condition of a widow would be. She's living with Naomi now, but Naomi may die, and then she would be this foreigner, and she would have few resources. Gleaning is hard work. You can't count on someone like Boaz to be nice to you every time. And at some point, there's not going to be any harvest anymore to gather in. And that sense of the need for that husband and the provision that that would make is actually there at the very beginning of the book. If you flip back to chapter 1 and verse 9, where Naomi is trying to talk Ruth and Orpah out of coming back with her, Naomi says, "The Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband." And that same word, rest, comes up in this chapter also, the same sense that there is protection in the house of the husband. So that's where we left it last time, and as we'll see, in effect, Naomi helps to answer her own prayer that God would help Ruth to find rest, because God provides shelter for her through the instigation of Naomi. So here really in chapter 3 we come to the turning point of the story. So we've had the meeting with this Boaz by chance, it appears. We've had the generosity of Boaz, but by now it's probably been several weeks. They're threshing the grain and not apparently in the midst of the harvest anymore. And yet nothing has happened. But in this chapter something does happen. And to add to the intrigue, the main thing that happens between the two characters happens in the dead of night. Okay, so you know, you can just see the Harlequin novel with, you know, Ruth and Boaz and some steamy cover or something. What's going to happen here? That's the sense is that something significant is going to happen, but it happens in a very surprising way. But I'd like to emphasize, as I emphasized the first week, and maybe not so much last week, it's really the overruling providence of God. And we might say in spite or in accordance with, depending on how you look at it, what it is that the human characters do, God is working out his will. In particular, God is providing for the widow, and God is showing his covenant faithfulness to provide an heir. Okay, so that's the basic point of the chapter, and I want to follow the story through the way we did the story last week in chapter 2, and then step back and try to think of some of the lessons. I'm going to try to avoid just retelling the whole story, because I'm not a very good storyteller anyway, but there are some points that require explanation and highlight some of the themes that we've been looking at. So I'll try to note this as we go along. Okay. So here you have possibly the first time in the book Naomi taking significant initiative. So Naomi says to her daughter-in-law, "My daughter, shall I not seek security or rest for you, that it may be well with you?" So there's the idea of Ruth being a vulnerable person. Her situation is temporary, and she wants to seek a long-term solution, something that will help her, something so that she will prosper. Perhaps it's Naomi's recognition of God's covenant faithfulness that we saw in the last chapter, where she realizes that God had blessed her through Boaz, that encouraged her to take this initiative. In any case, she has this idea, and she describes to Ruth what the plan is going to be. Okay, so just a few facts about winnowing. I think you're all familiar, or at least heard of descriptions about what winnowing is. So when you harvest the grain, it's not in a usable form. You have to separate the wheat from the chaff, or the barley from the chaff, and whatever it is you're threshing. So there would be a threshing floor where the pieces would be probably stamped on, or if they had more advanced machinery, some other way in which that initial separation would take place. And then they would throw, you know, the picture, they would throw it up in the air and the wind would separate the two. Well, unlike Oklahoma, they had to wait for the wind, okay? So they had the wind more in the evening, and that's why she refers in verse 2, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. It seemed like a strange time to do it, but of course it's cooler then, and also they would have the evening breezes for that work. Now, the threshing floor was apparently also something of a place of celebration. So it would be kind of a festive occasion in addition to the work that's done. And that makes sense in terms of the description here, that Boaz is going to have a nice meal, have something to eat and drink, and he'll be in a good mood. Okay. Which is, you know, there again is the clever woman, because she realizes she's going to set this up you might say, put Boaz in a vulnerable situation. But later on in history, there's at least one reference where the threshing floor was actually a place of something far worse, like cultic prostitution or something like that. It's not clear exactly what the associations were at this time, but it was certainly a place where there was great rejoicing as well as the work that had to be done. So Naomi tells Ruth what it is she's supposed to do. She's supposed to prepare herself and go down and not let anyone see her. And I think we know the story, so I won't retell that part. And then Ruth's response is significant in verse 5. All that you say to me, I will do. Ruth is from Moab. They may not do things like this in Moab, but she says, okay, mother-in-law, or mother, since she had been addressed as daughter, if that's what you want me to do, that's what I'll do. And there's the sense that Ruth is willing to follow through with her earlier commitment to be with her mother, to provide for, and in this case, to be willing to submit to her direction in this matter. Okay, so then verses 6 through 13 describe what it is that Ruth actually does and what happens in response. The first part of it makes it clear that Ruth really does carry out her mother's plan. She goes out, her mother-in-law's plan, she goes out and it says that Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was cheerful, sure enough. And so she goes down and lies at his feet, probably perpendicular to him, and uncovers his feet. And waits. Now, this is at night. It's in the dark. No one could see her. Apparently, he was isolated from the others, which is another part of the purpose of this. They needed an opportunity for a private conversation. It could hardly get more private than this, but there they are. And it says in verse 8, now it happened at midnight that the man was startled. The word that's startled is often used for being frightened, but since here he hasn't recognized quite what's going on, it may here mean that he shivered. After all, she took the covers off of his feet, and it's getting really late, and it's getting cold. And so suddenly his feet are cold, and he rolls over, and then, as it says in the original, behold, or something like that, lo and behold, there's a woman at his feet. Okay, this is a rather unusual situation for someone like Boaz to find himself in. Boaz is a highly respected person. He's known as a man of virtue, has a great reputation and influence in the community. No doubt it places him in an awkward situation. It doesn't happen every threshing season that this occurs. There's a woman lying at his feet. Now, he asks who she is, and she addresses him in a way that's very different. And this is, again, as part of the author's literary ability in shifting the way Ruth addresses Boaz. She doesn't refer to herself indirectly and emphasize her lowly position. Even the word maidservant is probably more exalted than what we would think of. She says to him, addressing a peer, I am Ruth. Not I am that, you know, foreigner, Moabitess, who came and I can't even talk to you, that sort of thing. She addresses him directly, I am Ruth. And then this is the first place where apparently she deviates from her mother-in-law's instructions. She was supposed to do that, and Naomi says, he will tell you what you should do. Apparently Ruth isn't entirely satisfied with that, and so she takes a bit of initiative and says, take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. Now, in effect, what she's saying is, marry me. Okay? She's proposing marriage to Boaz. Okay? Don't drop dead or faint or anything like that, but that's exactly what she's saying. And part of the confusion comes because they're two very similar Hebrew words, the New King James Version, and I think also the ESV, both use this translation, take your maidservant under your wing, but I think there are translation footnotes in each of these that refer to spreading the corner of your garment over your maidservant. And that seems to be more fitting to the situation here. Spreading the corner of the garment over the maidservant, okay, again, that doesn't sound like a proposal of marriage, but that's the language that's used elsewhere in Scripture for a husband taking a wife to himself. I only put one reference on the board for that, Ezekiel 16:8. There are other similar references. So she is, in effect, saying, take me as your wife. Spread your garment over me. But there's probably kind of a play on words here, and that's why the two translations are given. Take your maidservant under your wing should remind us of what Boaz actually said to Ruth in the last chapter. What did he say to her in verse 12? The Lord repay your work. This is 2:12. And a full reward be given to you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. Now, she found shelter in God, and we talked about that last week in terms of God as the God of the covenant and of protection and deliverance. And Ruth fled the protection of Chemosh, the god of Moab, and found protection under the God of Israel. But in effect, she's saying, okay, Boaz, answer your own prayer, because I need further protection, and I want you to spread your wings over me. There's that play on words, I think, that's implicit there, that Ruth is saying that she is looking to Boaz to carry this out. And she adds, again, something that Naomi hadn't mentioned, for the reason, in other words, for you are a close relative. So you are a kinsman redeemer, she says. This is something that's relevant to you. This is something that you should consider as an obligation because you are our kinsman redeemer. Now, I want to come back to why she added all of that, but let me just make one comment here, that one practical reason. If a woman lies down at the feet of a man in the middle of the night in an isolated place, she could have various intentions, okay? In effect, Ruth is saying up front, my intentions are honorable here. I want you to marry me. Okay? Now, there's further that you can say because of that, and it's further underlines who Ruth is and her faithfulness. But at least at this point, let me make that comment, that by saying that, she, in a sense, is attempting at least to set Boaz's mind at ease. Okay. Now, the question is going to be, how is Boaz going to react? Boaz, as we said, is a virtuous person. Here he is, apparently being, waylaid isn't the right word, but his privacy is being invaded, we might say, by this young lady in the middle of the night. Puts him in a very awkward position. What is he going to say? And the reaction is consistent with the way Boaz acted in the previous chapter. Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter. So there again is the tender address that he used before in calling her my daughter. She is therefore accepted in the family of God. She's accepted as an Israelite, even though she was by birth a Moabite. She's accepted within his family circle. He treats her with great tenderness, whereas he could have said, what are you doing here? Get out of here. Are you crazy? Instead, he says, blessed are you of the Lord. Now, why is she blessed of the Lord? Well, he gives the reason in verse 10, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, the sense here, the end and the beginning, is, as one commentator paraphrased it, you've outdone yourself, Ruth, because you started by showing great kindness to Naomi by covenanting, by taking a vow to be given over to the God of Israel, and by covenanting in particular to be with Naomi, even in her great poverty, and to be with her until death. It was a permanent relationship that Ruth had entered into, and that great kindness, and that word kindness is the word we talked about last week. We looked at this verse last week. This is the word chesed, the word for loving kindness or mercy or faithfulness. It emphasizes the covenant relationship. But here it's Ruth who shows that. Ruth shows covenant faithfulness in that she She first entered into the covenant and cared for Naomi, went with her back to the land of promise, to Bethlehem. But here he says, you've outdone yourself. Now, how has she outdone herself? Well, shall we say, Boaz is not a spring chicken, okay? Boaz is considerably older than Ruth is. In fact, so is Naomi. One commentator notes that when Naomi and Boaz speak, their language is such that it makes them sound old-fashioned. Okay, so it's like, now, dearie, you know, you need to get all dressed up to go out and meet that man. It's that sort of, apparently in the Hebrew, it's that sort of talk. And it's that way when Boaz spoke in the last chapter also. That emphasizes the distance between Boaz and Ruth. In other words, Ruth isn't chasing after Boaz for his youth and vigor, okay? Now, he recognizes that. I mean, the guy is quite realistic about the situation. He says that her greater, even greater kindness than the kindness shown at the beginning to her mother-in-law is the kindness shown here, and that she didn't go after young men, whether poor or rich. She didn't marry for love or money, okay? So the poor, you know, might have been some good-looking young guy, didn't have a lot of money, she didn't go after him. Might have been other young men, and probably she would have been working with people like that in the field. In the last chapter, when she was doing her gleaning, there were probably lots of young men who noticed her, paid attention to her, this available young woman. But she didn't go after any of them. Now, that sounds like kind of a strange thing to praise someone for. I mean, is it really a virtue to marry someone that much older than you? Is that what he's saying? So all you young ladies here, you know, add 50 years to your age or something, and there you go. Well, it's not clear there was that much difference. But no, the point is a little bit more subtle. And it has to do, again, with that statement that Ruth actually added. In addition to Naomi's instructions, remember she said, take your maidservant under your wing or spread the corner of your garment over me, for you are a close relative. It's actually what Ruth is saying is, my intention, or we might say my interest in you, Boaz, is for you to provide an heir for my mother-in-law. Okay? It's not about security for me, even, which is what Naomi's intention was. It's not about my having even my own line preserved. But the connection is ultimately the connection with the law of the kinsman redeemer, and in particular the desire that the name of Elimelech, that is Naomi's husband, shouldn't perish, shouldn't be extinguished. And it's a pretty impressive thing. I mean, this is a tough situation to put a young lady in, to go to this, and even more so is the fact that, in essence, Naomi is trying to provide a husband for her somehow, but Ruth is really saying, no, my ultimate aim in this is really not a selfish one. My ultimate aim is to provide for the name of my deceased father-in-law. And that's why Boaz reacts the way he does. That's why he praises her as having even greater faithfulness, because she wasn't seeking her own pleasure, but seeking to honor her mother, her mother-in-law. They refer to each other as daughter and, I guess, as mother also. So that's the point of the reaction of Boaz here, and I think why Ruth departed from the script, if you will, to make it clear not only that she has good intentions, but even to make it clear that her intentions aren't really selfish ultimately, but are for someone else. So let me make just a comment here about the kinsman redeemer. You may remember last week that I listed the law's obligations for the kinsman redeemer. And if you pay attention, this wasn't one of them. Okay? There was nothing in the law that said a kinsman redeemer had to marry into the family, basically, to provide a seed for the family, to provide an heir. There is a similar law, the law of the Levirate. It's pronounced in different ways, I guess, but the law by which like a brother would provide an heir for his deceased brother by marrying the widow of the one who was deceased. Apparently that's not the situation here. It's not a reference to that, because Boaz wasn't just a brother-in-law of Naomi. But instead, it's probably a general application. The point of the specific examples that we looked at last week in terms of what the obligations of the kinsman redeemer were, the point of those is simply to say that the family is an important part of society. And here I'm thinking of the extended family, not just the nuclear family, as it's often called. The extended family was an important part of society. And the point of the law of the kinsman redeemer was to do what we could to seek to preserve, or what they could to seek to preserve the family. And that's why if you had a family member and sold himself into slavery, that you should try to redeem him, and you should try to keep the property and the family, again, broadly defined. And so here the obligation to provide an heir is part of that general obligation to care for the good of the extended family. That's probably the idea here. And Boaz certainly doesn't say, hey, wait a second, show me what chapter and verse says that I have to do that. He doesn't react in that way. He accepts her request as a legitimate request, even though he, of course, is going to explain that he can't necessarily fulfill it himself. Okay, just a couple of more comments, and then we'll pause. He says that he will do, verse 11, what she has requested. And he says that she will do it because of her reputation. So I want to come back to that when we look at some of the themes of the chapter. But he says, all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. That's pretty remarkable, because although it apparently has been some time since they've been there, from the beginning of the harvest, which is when they arrived, to the threshing, that's not a long time. And yet already Ruth has a reputation in town as being a virtuous woman. Again, I want to come back to that description. It's a pretty interesting word. But that's the way her reputation has been. And Boaz says, this is a perfectly good reason for me to fulfill your request. Okay, and then there's the twist in the story. The twist in the story is that there is a closer kinsman redeemer. Okay. Whether Naomi knew about this or not, you know, she might have thought, well, Boaz was nice to Ruth, so maybe we'll go after him first. It's not exactly clear, but he does bring out the fact that there is a closer relative. And the closer relative may view this as a good opportunity. And Boaz, the language here suggests that Boaz sees it as a good opportunity. It's something he delights to do, something he wants to do. That's what the original suggests. Doesn't come through so well in verse 12 in the translation. Verses 12 and 13. But Boaz says, in essence, if this guy wants to pass, then I will take up the opportunity, and I will do it. In fact, he swears in verse 13 that he will do it as the Lord lives. So it's an oath that he takes to perform his duty. Okay. I think I'm going to pause there as the transition comes to how you're going to get them out of this rather delicate situation. And I'll ask for comments or questions, but let me say first that I'm going to try to get through the chapter, and then I will say something about whether this is a fitting thing to do, or was a fitting thing to do. I think it's pretty clear for us it's not a fitting thing to do. But if we could make comments and ask questions about anything, then like, what in the world were they thinking? Then that'll be good, because I don't want to distract us too much from the main point of it. But with that proviso, any comments or questions on the first, I guess it's 13 verses? What a placid group we are this morning. Okay. Let me just add, I'll add a comment. That is that this custom of spreading the garment over your bride-to-be is apparently still practiced in the Middle East. So I'll have to ask the McCulloughs about that sometime. But that's the that reference there in terms of marry me, is essentially what Ruth is saying, is still something that happens today. Okay, in verses 14 through 18, the two part, right? Now, you know, Boaz could have sent Ruth packing, but having a single woman wandering around in the middle of the night is probably not a good idea. Typically, women who are out at that time of the night are not out to any good, and she would have been vulnerable anyway. So he says to her that she is supposed to lie down. This is actually the end of verse 13, lie down till morning. And the idea is that they get up before, so it's twilight, okay, before anyone could actually recognize anyone else, they get up, and he doesn't want it to be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. Now, that's clear for their own reputations, right? Like, what were you two doing together all night? Now, that sort of question would be a natural one, but even more so for what he wants to do in the next chapter, right? If this closer kinsman redeemer is even to consider caring for Ruth, we don't want any evidence that there was anything going on between Ruth and Boaz before. So that's part of the reason, and the gift of the barley is probably intended also to provide something of an alibi, I guess we might say, for Ruth. She's been working all night. See, she's got all this grain. In any case, it would have that secondary effect. But he gives her a large amount. The New King James Version has 6 ephahs of barley. The word ephah is italicized. The original just says 6 of barley. The original unit of measurement was left out. This would drive engineers and physicists crazy, but they left out the unit of measurement, mathematicians do. But it's presumably ephah, which would be a large amount. So again, the estimates were 60 to 95 pounds. Okay, so she had something like a huge headscarf, and he would have put all of this in there. After all, he was right next to the pile of grain, so he would have given her all this. She would have carried it on her head or shoulders. I guess they're used to doing that kind of thing. Gives me a headache thinking about it. And then she went back to the city. So she comes to her mother-in-law in verse 16. So she knocks on the door. You know, it's still probably pretty dark. And the question that Ruth is asked by Naomi, here in the New King James it says, "Is that you, my daughter?" And then it has a translation footnote, "How are you?" It's actually exactly the same question that Boaz asked Ruth at midnight. Who are you? So she comes to the door, and Ruth comes to the door. Naomi says, "Who are you?" Now, it's not, I think, that she couldn't tell who she was. There wouldn't be that many people knocking on her door at that time of day. She'd probably been up all night wondering how things were going to go. She probably expected the knock on the door. There are various interpretations of that in terms of thinking of her new identity, that Naomi is thinking further about who she really is. I thought of a different one, which is, are you Mrs. Boaz? Who are you? What's your name now? But anyway, whatever it is, she asks that question, and Ruth presumably excitedly refers to what had happened, and you know, says, "These 6 ephahs of barley on my head he gave to me." And it's a very striking thing. This statement of Boaz wasn't given earlier in the account, but it says that the main purpose, whatever a secondary purpose there may have been, the main purpose for giving the grain is that she should not go empty-handed to her mother-in-law. So Boaz recognized Ruth's care for her mother-in-law, and he too cared for her and didn't want her to go back empty-handed. So I want to come to that idea again when we look at some of the themes. But Ruth is assured by Naomi that she should be patient and wait. Naomi knows Boaz and knows that he will follow through what he has said. Okay, is Naomi's plan justified? Okay, just about every commentator from the Puritans down to our own day asked the same question, and there are a variety of responses. Some people say, no, this is a terribly bad idea. Okay, and I think the explanations are obvious. You're sending a young, apparently attractive young woman into a situation where she's with a man, and they are quite isolated and in the night, and it's just asking for trouble. Okay, that's a basic objection that people make, and I'll have to admit that it does raise questions of delicacy whether this is the appropriate thing to do. It could be that Naomi felt that things weren't moving along, and so some people have said Naomi is really acting the way Sarah acted with Abraham and giving her her maiden to be the concubine of Abraham. It could be that Naomi is taking initiative that she shouldn't have taken to try to get things to happen when they would have happened the proper way. Other commentators point out that the that Naomi knew who Boaz was as a virtuous person. She knew who Ruth was as a virtuous person. And she was really counting that although it was a risky undertaking, that it was something that had to happen for them to be able to discuss this matter. It's true from the Old Testament law that a woman could take an initiative in a situation like this. So in Deuteronomy 25, I referred earlier to this law where the widow could expect her brother-in-law basically to give her a child. And if that failed to happen, the widow could, in essence, take the initiative and, you know, haul the guy in and say, "What's up, man?" So there is some basis for taking this kind of initiative. Further complicating the fact is, actually, if you look at the original Hebrew, there are all sorts of innuendos. There are all sorts of terms that could be understood in a perfectly honest and virtuous way, or also understood in terms of sexual overtones. Okay, so I don't really want to go through all of those, but there are terms like that which at least underline the fact that Naomi was aware of the potentials of what could happen. Okay? It may have been for her a way of warning Ruth, you know, "I'm putting you in a delicate situation in case you didn't notice." It could be that it was some kind of a custom that was followed at that time. I think what all the commentators agree on is that, you know, don't try this at home. What is it they say when they're doing, you know, weird experiments on TV? Well, don't try this at home. Okay, so this is obviously not a practice to be imitated now. There are plenty of warnings in Scripture about not putting oneself in a delicate, dangerous situation. But that's a brief discussion about whether Naomi should have done what she did. I think people basically agree that Ruth wasn't aware of the way things worked. She probably wondered whether this was a really good idea, but her submission to her mother in verse 5, "All that you say to me, I will do," seems to be an acknowledgement that her mother knows what she's doing and she's willing to go along with it. So I want to step back and look at some of the things that we can reflect on in the chapter. And the first is to emphasize again the sovereignty of God. Now, it's important to emphasize that because the sovereignty of God is not actually mentioned explicitly. I said at the beginning that the book of Ruth is in some ways like the book of Esther. The book of Esther actually doesn't mention the name of God at all, but underlying all of that, including the fact that the king couldn't go to sleep that one night and, you know, just had this chance meeting and everything worked out just right so that he read the record, that same sense of the superintending providence of God is here and is clearer. There are references that are very subtle. We saw last week that it said that Ruth chanced upon a chance to go into Boaz's field, okay? And here, when it says in verse 18 of chapter 3 that until you know how the matter will turn out, Naomi says that to Ruth. The word "how the matter will turn out" is how things will fall out, we might say. It's actually probably an allusion to the use of the lot, okay? Well, of course, when any good Bible reading Israelite read about chances and lots, they knew that the lot was cast in the lap, but the outcome is from the Lord. And that implicit reference by extreme understatement is underlined here. The providence of God is underlined here and in chapter 2 by the references to God and God's determination. It's God who is referred to in verse 10 as the one who blessed Naomi for her good, for Ruth rather, for her faithfulness. And it's God by whom Boaz swears to perform his duty. So he acknowledges the hand of God in these things. And we saw again and again in the earlier chapters that it's really God that's working maybe behind the scenes as far as human perception goes, but it's ultimately God's provision. And that's particularly the case in the way the word empty is used. So I mentioned this in verse 17. Boaz said, "Do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law." Well, the significance of that is that you remember the way Naomi described herself when she returned to Bethlehem? This is back in chapter 1, in verse 21. Naomi says to the people who greet her and says, "Hey, it's good to see you, Naomi." And she says, "Well, call me Mara." She says, "I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty." So here is God's provision for her. The woman who was empty is now full again because it's the provision of God that Boaz has made. Do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She should know that God is providing for her. First, food, but also the promise of the inheritance and the seed that she desired still to come. And that's reinforced also by the providence of God, also by the provision of rest for Ruth. We talked about the idea of rest or security in the husband. That was rest in God, and yet it was God who would provide rest in a practical way by providing a husband for her. So it's the great faithfulness of God. It's God's work to reverse the condition of the lowly. That's God caring for the poor and the widow. Maybe just to underline that point, I'd like to turn in your Bibles, probably just flip over a few pages to 1 Samuel 2. Remember Hannah's prayer. Hannah was in a lowly condition. She was troubled without children. And I'll just read one of the verses here. 1 Samuel 2, 5, Hannah says, "Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, and the hungry have ceased to hunger. Even the barren has borne seven, and she who has many children has become feeble." That's just a sample from that, but that's one of the great biblical themes, that God raises up the lowly. God cares for the poor and the outcast, those who trust in Him, and God casts down the proud. And so when you see the great reversal in Naomi's life from the empty one, empty in more ways than one, it wasn't just her belly that was empty, it was that she had lost all that it seemed that she ever had, including the hope of an heir. God is the one who works to reverse that. And that's important because when we think of Boaz acting as a kinsman redeemer, we should think of the work of our Lord Jesus. I talked about this a little bit last week. The word redeemer is familiar in the New Testament, but it's illustrated in the Old Testament for us by this practice of someone who was a close relative and who helped people out of dire conditions. And it's striking how many of these ideas that we've seen in this chapter are ascribed to the work of Jesus in the New Testament. Jesus is the one who gives us rest and security. Think of the book of Hebrews. We have that hope as an anchor because we have Christ as a mediator. Jesus is described as the one who is the husband of the church and therefore provides all that we need. And even and especially in the case of Ruth, the sense of acceptance of a foreigner, Jesus is the one who brings in the outcast, those who were outside of the covenant, and joins them to the people of God. So it's a beautiful thing to reflect on, the way that God provided for, you might say, the practical needs of Ruth and Naomi. Food to eat, I mean, that's really practical, the hope of an heir. And that it also points forward to the work of Jesus in redeeming a people in a greater way. But I want to close with this thought, and that is that we tend perhaps to separate the two. Here's this nice story about Ruth and Naomi. Didn't have any food, didn't have a husband. Look, now she's got a husband, they got kids, they got food to eat. This is really nice. And then in the end, we think about David, and so we look forward to Jesus. I made this point the first week, but it's really important to realize that the two are connected. That is, God chose to work in history to bring about the coming of the Messiah by providing a husband for Ruth and an heir for Naomi and Ruth. And that's really the whole point of the book. It is that, to put it in terms of last week, is that God's covenant faithfulness works out in history in a practical way so that our response in covenant faithfulness becomes part of his means of blessing even future generations. So don't think of it as a nice story about Ruth, but it also on some other level has to do with Jesus. Think of it as a reminder that when we respond to God's covenant faithfulness and act in virtue, in faithfulness, acting according to God's law, that God will bless us and use us to bless future generations. And so for that reason, I think it is worthwhile for us to reflect on the example of, in particular, Ruth and Boaz. Okay, I mean, I'm not going to do a little lecture on chastity, so if young men, if there's ever a woman at your feet in the middle of the night, you'll know what to do. I think that part's pretty obvious. But I want to come back to this word virtuous. In verse 11, all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. It's the word that appears in the book of Proverbs, chapter 31. I pointed out last week in some arrangements of the Hebrew Bible, Proverbs is the book right before Ruth, so that people would be reading about this, you know, Proverbs 31 woman, and then they turn over to Ruth and have the example. Okay, well, in Proverbs 31:10, it's exactly the same. 31, I lost my place here. Yeah, 31:10, it's exactly the same word as used here. She is a virtuous woman. What's striking is that it's actually the same word that's used about Boaz in the beginning of the chapter. And it's translated a man of great wealth. I pointed out last week, the word actually means like a man of valor. It's like a war hero. Okay. Although the same thing is said about Ruth. The virtuous woman in Proverbs 31, originally the phrase had to do with a person of valor. Okay. Now you may think that raising a bunch of little kids and, you know, going and doing all that weaving and probably does require a war hero mentality. Mothers of young children may appreciate that. But the point I want to make is really the fact that what attracted Boaz to Ruth was that they were a good match. And how were they a good match? Because they were both people of virtue. The priority in marriage, in that case, was not in the first place attraction, although presumably Ruth was attractive. Not sure how attractive this old fellow Boaz was. But the thing that came first to mind was the sense of virtue. And that is, I think, not reading anything out of the account, but really a basic part of the account. That's the covenant faithfulness that's shown, that Ruth isn't out chasing after people who might be expected to be better peers for her, but instead she seeks out Boaz in part because Boaz is also a man of valor. Then just one other comment, and that is another thing to see how God blesses covenant faithfulness is how Naomi and Ruth seem to outdo each other in unselfishness. Okay, so Naomi's main point in all of this was to get a husband for Ruth. But Ruth's main point in all of this is to provide an heir for Naomi. It's the same sense of kindness and generosity that we saw in Boaz in the last chapter, and you actually see here too. But the same seeking the good of others, and as Christ Jesus did, not his own, but to seek the good of others in humility, doing the thing that's right and full of covenant faithfulness. Okay, any comments or questions? Just one more chapter. I don't know if anyone's holding his or her breath, but they do get married in the end. This other guy bails out, just in case you were worrying. Any comments or questions? Okay, let's close in prayer.